On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Special theme for a special guest for a special topic today. Yes, it's a roaring time on The Conversation Hour today. Roar is the title of a new book that's been put together by Sam Lane. Samantha Lane has written the story behind Women's Footy on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and all the rest of it. This is The Conversation Hour. Sam Lane is my co-host today. Morning to you, Sam.
Hello, John.
Congratulations.
Thank you for the introduction, verbal and musical.
Yeah. Well, I take credit for it, but in fact, I had no idea it was even there. That was all John Standish's clever work.
Well, that was very nice. I've got little neighbours at home and they're little girls who love a nice pop song and they're now singing that song permanently, and I didn't even ask them to, so I think it's their parents, and I thank them very much for it. It's given me a few bunk-ups along the way of writing the book.
Driving you mad, are they?
No, no.
Kids next door won't shut up.
No, no, no. It was quite morale-boosting at points.
Your book is the kind of behind-the-scenes look at why we've ended up with this incredibly successful Women's Football League. Mm. And one of the things that you tell us is that there are names that we know, like Sam Mostyn, who you celebrate her success. She was the first female commissioner. Yep. Linda Dessau, now our state governor, who was the second commissioner. And you go on to run through Susan Alberti, who's written her own book and tells her own story. But none of us have ever heard of Gemma Wong.
Oh, yeah.
And as much as anyone, as I read your book, we have women's footy because of Gemma Wong, but well, no one's heard her story.
Well, that's really interesting, and it's so nice. We haven't had this conversation off air in any capacity, so it's really nice to actually hear that that's what you've taken. I thought you were going to say the name Jan Cooper, because in my investigation, and that's what I was trying to do, this is only the first 70 pages of the book, and then it rolls into chapters on incredible heroes that we know, like Daisy Pierce, Darcy Vesio, Taylor Harris, etc. But in this first 70 pages, what I wanted to do was try to go back and put on the record some of the roadblocks that existed, whether they were actually people or whether they were just prejudices or whether it was just discrimination or misunderstanding. And where
there's the negatives, the people
correct.
Who just tried to stop it. But then there's this extraordinary story, a young marketing executive who'd never seen a game of footy who turns out to be one of the great secrets of its success.
But I will get to her in a minute because that's Gemma Wong. When I started to try to get the lay of the land, John, where it took me back, if I had to pinpoint why AFLW happened, it's because a woman called Jan Cooper sought out Sam Mostyn. And Jan Cooper was just at home in WA. She had a job with the AFL. She was a school teacher, but she just joined as the head of female football development, they called it. It was part-time initially on a wage of, I think, about 60 grand that received kickback from the AFL executive at the time. So get that for a bit of context. Anyway, Jan was watching telly. She saw Sam Mostyn on Q&A talking about sustainability and all other sorts of wonderful erudite things. And she thought, gee, she was interesting. Jan goes on her morning walk the next day, tells her friend about this woman, Sam Mostyn. And the person said, well, that's the new first ever female AFL commissioner. So Jan seeks out Sam and then starts this process of educating the only woman on the otherwise male AFL commission about what Jan knew was a latent force that could be grasped by the AFL and made into something that it did become. But that took years. It took years and years of Sam Mostyn sitting in meetings, seeing the eyes glaze over, feeling the time checking, all of these things that are also discussed in this first 70 pages.
I'll let her have her say. She'll run out of steam eventually.
Yeah. Do you really want to go and present medals to those girls? Okay, if that's what you want to do.
Why are you wasting your time?
Kind of thing. Men play footy. We run an elite code that is for men. Okay? That was the feeling. That was the business model. And they were focusing to give them some you know, balance on expansion.
And then they said, well, at least we could have some more women on some of the boards, so each board should have one or two.
But that's been very slow, John.
Yeah, and there are still some clubs that aren't doing it.
Correct, and I'm surprised you bring in Gemma Wong this early, because it was only once the AFL machine grasped that this had some currency in the currency that they understood, which is dollar signs. And that only came when Channel 7 broadcast the first game of women's footy for, you know, an AFL endorsed game on television, and it rated the house down. That was the end of 2015. And then the exec got around it and went, okay, wow, we've got something here. And that was when Gillon McLachlan and co pressed go. Now, only then was Gemma Wong even in the picture, because what Gemma Wong, for listeners, did was essentially create the whole thing of see what we create, the marketing, the everything that you see about women's football, the presentation on social media, the slogans. She really drilled down into the intellectual property behind it as well. So she brought the word feminism to the AFL. I would sort of argue that that was actually a bit of a dirty word beforehand. But now, you know, this is all fine. And in fact, it's not just fine. It's absolutely fantastic. So that's a short form, but I thought you were going to start with Jan Cooper, because actually she's just left the AFL and is going to be working for the West Coast Eagles. If it were not for her and for Sam Mostyn, there is no way that AFLW would have launched last year. And of course it required the entire commission. So that was headed by Mike Fitzpatrick when they said yes. Bill Kelty was a great advocate. Colin Carter was essential.
President of Geelong.
Yeah. But it's been a tapestry,
yeah,
and a male and female tapestry.
Sure. Look, success has many parents, failure's an orphan. This is undoubtedly now, it's here to stay. It's come earlier than people predicted. It's been more successful than anyone predicted. But there is undoubtedly still a significant core of people who are dismissing it as a short-term fad, a fashion, a little blip on the radar. As fast as it's come, it'll be gone. Once you start charging people to get in, no one will go. The women who have been attracted to it will all end up going off back to other sports, and the whole bubble will burst.
Well, they'll do that if they don't get properly paid. And they're being very graceful right now, the women who are playing, in accepting that this is the beginning. They will go to other sports if they don't get proper pay. But quite aside from that, the other thing that you hear, and let's go there, if we're half going to go there with the criticisms, let's put it in. The skills aren't good enough. What are they doing? It's gimmicky. Why would I want to watch this?
Not enough goals are being scored.
Exactly. And we heard that came out of the very first game of season one, you know, and you know, we read I'm No Longer at the Age, as you know, but I've been following with great interest that the AFLW coaches will be spoken to by the AFL about let's try and get more scoring. Well, okay.
No, it's like the old Sydney Crush. I mean, the idea is to win a game.
So that is your motivation. That is your number one if you're a coach or a player.
I would have thought so.
Yes. So let's wind this back a little. The way I would like to term it is, if you are the poor, embarrassing cousin or sister or relative of a massive organisation that just happens to be the biggest, most powerful, richest and most influential sport in Australia, and you are told that we don't really care about you, or you at very least get that feeling, and you are not nurtured, you are not valued, you do not thrive. Now, it is only recent times that in earnest the AFL has said we need to get these women and girls to elite standards. They will now be plucked out, as we see young boys and young men who are good at footy. They just show a bit of talent and they get tapped on the shoulder. They have pathways, John. These women, for a while there, until laws change, actually fell into a black hole because they couldn't even keep playing football after a certain age. So if you are not nurtured and groomed as an athlete to be the very best, well, you're not going to be. So this is, in terms of skill, this is the beginning.
a female player kicking another female player in the groin, is it the same as a male player kicking another male player in the groin?
It's funny. It is, according to the match review panel, and Sarah Darcy was offered a 3-match suspension, 2 matches if she took an early plea.
At which she did, and she's serving.
Correct. I actually asked and I sent a message to someone on the day that we were discussing it on Channel 7 Saturday night, is it different because of anatomy? And the answer that I got was, no, it's not. It's kicking, it's groin. Groin is a sensitive region. That was the answer.
And what does Sam Lane think?
I think that's fair enough. You can do damage whether you kick you or me there.
True. I don't know enough about the experience of a woman being kicked in the groin. I certainly know as a bloke what it's like. I've experienced it once and it's not pleasant.
Yeah, and I'm guessing I've never been kicked in the groin as
not,
you have.
Not many women have.
No, and I'm guessing it's not pleasant either. And we are talking about vital parts, John.
And we're rapidly getting into an area that neither of us really want to go further in.
Well, I think we've maybe agreed in a funny little way that we don't want to be kicked and we should rule it out. Shall we? Should we get rid of that in the game?
I think the message needs to be sent very clearly to the women that we don't mind a bit of physical contact. We don't mind the game being played within the rules, but anyone who is deliberately breaching the rules and doing things like that will expect to be spending quite a bit of time watching her friends going running around without it.
Agree. And they've made that point very quickly. They did last year too. I think it was the first or second round where a very overzealous and excited Rochelle Cranston, Rocky Cranston, found herself in front of the match review panel. And it was awkward. You know, no one really wanted this, but it's good. This is footy.
It is footy and it's exciting footy and it's certainly drawing crowds. Take me 10 years into the future. 10 years ago, no one would have thought we'd be where we are now in 2018. Where are we with women's footy in 2028?
Okay. In 10 years, every AFL club as we know it has a men and a women's team.
Professional team. Fully professional?
In 10 years, yes.
National competition?
Yes.
Through the winter?
That's really... I'm not sure about that. I think right now they're enjoying the AFL and good on them. They get an extra 8 weeks of people going to matches by
and
doing this.
And talking about footy.
Yeah.
And robbing cricket and other sports of the oxygen that footy pretty much deserves and gets.
Yep, or at least encroaching. So they have this choice, but of course once the competition expands, it's necessarily a longer competition. So... right now, it's very neat for them. Australian Open, they've got Channel 7 as broadcaster. Channel 7 finishes that, goes straight into AFLW, goes straight into AFL Men's. What happens if you're making it longer? Now, Craig Starcevich, who's the only man who's featured as a chapter in Raw.
There's about 10 women and one man, yeah.
Correct. And Craig, who I love as a story, and actually Lucy Race from the Outer Sanctum podcast actually tweeted this morning. I was quite concerned that she was crying on the train reading the book. And I wrote back publicly, "What? Are you okay? Just keep reading. It gets happy." And she wrote back, no, it's fine. They're happy tears. I'm reading Craig Starcevich. And Craig found his happy place, a man that won a premiership, like God status in AFL land, by winning a premiership with Collingwood Footy Club back in 1990. Craig Starcevich has found his happiest place in footy, full stop, by coaching the Brisbane Lions women. So anyway, he's a great story. But I digress. His view, and it's also in the book, is that he thinks that the best place for AFL women's is actually in the summer. So finish AFL men's and then roll into AFL women's.
What, in November?
I think he was saying as early as October.
October, straight off the back of the last Saturday in September.
Yeah.
Wow, no break. Start the women, bang, into it. Yep. So run a whole season through summer competing with cricket, competing with the Australian Tennis Open.
No, because that's not till January. So well, if
it would
you're
be
doing,
finished by then. No, well, if you, you had a full season, it
October,
would go longer.
October, November, December, January. Yeah, but started October.
If you've got all the same clubs having women's teams as men's teams, then your season's going to be the same length.
Yes.
Although I might say I still have problems with a football schedule that doesn't have each team playing each other team the same number of times.
Well, so the solution here, if AFL Women's really goes off the way that people want it to, and I certainly support, maybe what it actually forces in a good way is that what I would say nirvana state for AFL to actually have each team play each other once. So you actually reduce the length of the men's season. We've been told year after year you can't do that because we've got broadcasting agreements. It's in our interest to keep having AFL men's matches because it makes us money. People come, they're still interested. But if AFL women's goes well, you could have every men's club playing each other once and then have every women's team playing each other once. And that might be a nice little neat fix.
Or you could just let the Gold Coast and Western Sydney clubs go broke, wind them up, get rid of them and have a better competition that way.
But of course, John, you'd be introducing Tassie and the Northern Territory with their own teams.
Good one. Very good. Sam Lane's written a book called Raw, the stories behind AFLW. And it makes for a great read. The first, 80 pages or thereabouts?
70-odd.
70 pages are a rollicking history of the development. And then there's a whole lot of little character studies of individual people, almost all of whom, only one is a male, the rest are all the women, the stars of the game. And it tells their personal stories in very moving ways. And there's all sorts of surprises in there. And that's what helps you understand what the backstories are. And then you care even more about how they progress.
Thanks.
Congratulations. It's taken a year of hard work for the former Age football writer, still Channel 7 and I wish ABC, occasional contributor Sam Lane.
You know the people that run this show, John.
If only they listened to me. Welcome to Lunatics to the studio, Brody and Paul. Sam Lane is my co-host. Her book, Raw, the stories behind AFLW. Oh, look, she's got about 50 text messages.
Oh.
You want to know what they are?
Okay.
Most of them saying things like, can I get a signed copy?
Yes.
And where there's a few people saying, I'm so sick of hearing about women's footy. Enough already. There's a bit of that.
Gee, it's only here every now and again. It's only just started. It's getting bigger.
Our next two guests, Brody Holland, used to play football for Collingwood, apparently. Brody, good morning to you.
Morning, John. How are you?
And Paul McDonald, the CEO of Anglicare. And look, if someone asked me to dangle off a skyscraper on the end of a piece of string, I know what I would say, but what did Paul and Brody say? Brody, what did you say?
Well, yeah, well, actually, I wasn't asked by these guys in particular. I was asked by my wife. So my wife actually was the advocate for Anglicare and also for Attitude Shift. She got asked and she said, I don't think I can do it without a bit of support. So I thought, hey, what better opportunity to do something I would not normally do and help Sarita out on the way down. But I think I was actually more scared than her on the way down, to be honest. But fantastic cause, obviously, supporting Anglicare. So
How many hours ago?
So literally we were hanging off the building about probably 9.40, 9.45, I think it was this morning. So it was a 112-metre building, St James Building down there in Bourke Street. And, it was interesting. We went through the process and they took us through how it was going to work and put the harness on and a little bit of training before we went down. And it was a scary moment right at the top when you're looking down. You can see the whole of Melbourne. You can see the bay. You can see the Eureka. Well, actually, I was starting to think, thank God it wasn't the Eureka Tower there for a while. Because
that's a good idea.
maybe that's next year.
Because Paul McDonald, who's the boss of Anglicare and former top public servant in the Victorian Public Service, has also been dangling down on a piece of string. How are your knees?
Well, it's a rope, John. It wanted to be a rope rather than a string.
It's a piece of string. How are your knees?
I didn't do it this morning, but I have done it. And once you get that edge, I mean, we want to provide people with an experience, maybe take them out of their comfort zone, or we've got some people who are looking for those thrill experiences. But really, we related this loosely to when a child is removed from a family that might be, the child in a neglectful situation. They're taken out of their comfort zone and placed into some beautiful carer homes. But, that transition into, gee, what am I getting myself in for? We loosely relate to, well, what's an experience that someone can have that probably can't replicate that, but gets close to their own personal journey about doing something unusual, maybe out of their comfort zone. And so abseiling down a 33-storey building and Brody and his wife did a fine job today. And you do get to the edge and... You know, you do. We're talking, Brody and I were talking about how he was saying you've got to get your feet on these two sort of dark and with this is where you get your foot. It's not necessarily going down the building. It's actually getting yourself backing up. But it was great, and I'm here to promote it rather than to talk people out. And it was a fantastic experience.
Here's an opportunity, because you're not as fresh as Brody just off this experience, Paul. How has it become a reference point already in your day-to-day life? Because I imagine, you know, when we take ourselves somewhere, even if we've had a hard experience, we can always reference back, oh, gee, well, I'm having a terrible day, but it wasn't as bad as ... Has it become a reference point like that?
Well, it has. And look, I'll tell you, we put Taisha, who's a young girl who's gone through our care, foster care, and she's now turned 18, and she went over just before Brody, abseiled, and I said to her, you know, you've stared down tougher stuff before this. And she wanted to do it because she's coming through care, and she can see sort of with the assistance that we're looking through the people signing up to it and thus raising some funds for children in state care under our care. The type of support we've given her has allowed her to get through school. We'll pay for and see her through university now, even though the state system finishes at 18. I'm happy to sort of say a few comments about that. It is a reference point. It is a reference point that when people have a look at what they've been through, I think the first point, Sam, is that really you, me, Brody, probably John as well, we've all been pretty lucky in our life. And we've got other kids who haven't had those sort of starts, and I think we can place ourselves into positions that maybe put us a bit out of that comfort zone that isn't risk-taking, but really can just appreciate maybe we can push ourselves a little bit for these kids ourselves.
And Brody, I know you as a footballer, really, and you played for Freo and for Collingwood, and we did a few interviews over the years. I'm interested in footballers are loath to say that anything is scary. How did this experience of stepping up to the plate, as Paul described, compare to the fear level that you probably wouldn't disclose at the time, but of every week actually going out to play a really hard contact sport?
I was actually using a couple of different experiences as references to this, and a couple of them were in the back of my mind was the 2003 AFL Grand Final. That was very nerve-wracking for me that whole week and leading in, especially obviously before you played. Probably the most
2003.
2003 grand final. Yes, we got beat by the Brisbane Lions by 10
John,
goals.
You've been baited.
So that was the Lions.
Here we go.
Anyway,
is this a
complete
rub in?
That's my advice. Just keep going. Plow on, Brody.
Let me talk, John, please.
Yes.
So the second one, moving on from that, is the first time I went out and Dancing with the Stars in 2005, in front of 2 million viewers and can't dance, can't really, you know, I couldn't speak in front of the camera at that stage, and I was just so nervous. So that was probably the next most nervous experience, and then this. There's probably three things.
And did you think of those things as you were standing there?
Not as I was standing there. Just on the drive on the way in, I'm thinking, geez, you know, I'm starting to feel that feeling that I had at that moment before the grand final, before that moment I stepped out into Dancing with the Stars. It's the same feeling inside the stomach. You know the butterflies, but the next level butterflies, the ones that are trying to bang their way out of your belly.
John, what's the most scary thing that you've done as in a physical challenge?
A physical challenge?
Yeah.
Parachuting.
Yeah?
Jumping solo out of an aeroplane.
When did you do that?
Wow.
I was at a party I was about 28 or 29. I was at a party with a couple of mates, and we all dared each other, if you do it, I'll do it. Oh, yeah, if you do it, I'll do it. And there were three of us, and so we all signed up for it, and then one of them broke his leg playing rugby. I mean, to the lengths people go to get out of doing it. But Dom and I went ahead and did it. We did it out at Labatouche out near Pakenham, and you do a kind of all-day course that they teach you how to get out of the plane without tangling everything up and how to roll when you fall and all this sort of stuff. And then off we went. We did two jumps. Wow. So solo jumps, not tandem. So you're jumping out on your own, but you're tethered to the plane. So as you jump out of the plane, the parachute automatically opens. You don't have to pull a ripcord. But you have to get out of the plane and get free. You stand on the wheel, holding on to the strut of the wing, and then you push yourself backwards out into the air, and you fall for about 6 or 7 seconds, and then the chute opens, it jerks you up, and then you float to the ground. And as the ground comes up to you, because you're not going to the ground, the ground's coming up to you, you have to brace yourself and then roll as you land.
Is this another rub-in?
And then I did the second one. I was so exhilarated afterwards. I was terrified beforehand, but I thought, I've said I'll do this, I'm going to do it. And then I did it. I immediately wanted to do it again.
A lot of people have that experience. Yeah,
yeah. And then we did. We did a second jump, and then we immediately wanted to do a third one because we were starting to kind of enjoy it, and it was getting a bit dark, and they said, it's over for today.
And is that, as I said to Brody and to Paul, has that been a reference point since for you, you know, when things have been a bit scary physically?
No.
That you did this? No? I'd use that.
No, it's just a bit of fun.
But you did it. Yeah, like, you conquered it. You could do anything.
I haven't thought about it for years until you asked me. Really? And I thought, well, I suppose that was, you know, that was pretty huge.
I tell you what, I, Sam, I took 3 or 4 days to get over it.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
Wow,
Because it was such a big, you know, you're throwing yourself to, we've got great people look after you, but you are putting yourself against the elements there. And when you reflect back on it, you get into it. But when you start to reflect, but gee, I just came down the side of a 33-story building and just what that meant, just with a rope.
String.
It took me 3 or 4 days to sort of, you know, get myself back down. I mean, Brody sort of has come up pretty well.
Hold your hand up. Steady as a rock.
Yeah,
wow.
He's just done this analysis.
I don't feel like that, though. I actually still feel like I'm shaking a little bit. Yeah, like still even now. You're kind of, the adrenaline's still pumping. Yeah,
that's right.
You know, and it's a kind of a weird kind of feeling.
Yeah. So it's an anxious-y feeling, or is it just...
Bit. A little bit anxiousy, a little bit, you know, the adrenaline's still pumping, and
would you like to find out, Sam?
Well.
Oh yeah, gosh, well, no, this
Sam,
is...
do you want to? We
come
can
on, line
go.
It up, line could, it up for
okay,
Sam.
Well,
come on.
Well, John and Sam, here's an open invitation: 27th, 28th of April. We'll go over.
Well, John's spruking his skydiving days.
Yeah, there you
days,
go. Like, this is only 120 metres rather than 10,000 feet, John.
Oh, look, I'm up for anything. I'll do anything, especially if it helps raise money for a worthy cause. So. I don't, you know, I ride motorbikes, I do all sorts of stuff people tell you not to do. I drove to London with our son, you know, I mean, you know, people said, don't do that, you'll never be seen again, you'll disappear off the face of the earth in the back of Kyrgyzstan or whatever. And the world's not scary place, it's not full of people trying to kill you. So, you know, I'm up for anything if it raises a profile of a worthwhile organisation and money for a good cause.
Well, it's certainly, for it's a
Sam's
off, offers both.
Looking
I was going to say, if John's going to do that,
here we go.
I could... be there. I would definitely be there. And I would like to interview John before and after. And I'm serious. And we'll record it. And if it's any good, John, you might replay it. And
what about in the middle?
Well, see, I'm scared. Yeah. And the closest I've got to doing what you're talking about and feeling that sensation was at the Adelaide Oval. Mm. And, you know, they redeveloped it and they did the Skywalk.
Oh, yes.
And so I think it was round one or two last year with the men's Saturday night footy. And Seven said, we'll get you up there. You can do a few live crosses during the game. And I was like, yep, great, sounds fun, blah, blah, blah. Went up and felt a bit wobbly, actually felt quite nauseous. And they changed
me. You're tethered.
I know.
It's like the Sydney Harbour Bridge Walk.
But my brain... didn't.
Okay.
My brain freaked.
No.
And it was serious. Like it freaked
a bit. It can be scary. You've reminded me all when I really was scared. I went out with the Sea Pilots once at Port Phillip Heads.
Oh, through the Heads here.
But in fact, I started out, I went out with a ship and then transferred to a Sea Pilot ship out at sea to come back.
Oh, you went down one of those side ladders down there.
Had to go down the rope ladder off the side of the container ship to get to the pilot boat waiting down the bottom, and doing all that with a tape recorder and a microphone. And it was a bit of a swell and the rope ladder was banging against the side of it. And then when you get down to the bottom, you've got to make sure you don't get sandwiched between the container ship and the little orange Sea Pilot boat.
Well, you've just popped that balloon for me, John, because I've always, my alternative fantasy job was being one of those Sea Pilots. So now...
they are amazing guys. Yeah. But that was terrifying.
Yeah. But is the mind over the matter, and this is an interesting topic, if you can just control that mind, I lost control of my mind.
Yeah.
And so there is a little step on that roof skywalk thing in Adelaide Oval, and they say, step out, put your arms out, sort of, you know, splay them out and lean back. And you're totally hooked. Like, you are, you know, you can see the bolt on your belly. You can see where it's, and I sort of got there and then I froze. But that was just a mind. It was, if I had a coach there saying, okay, come on, trust it. I reckon I could have done it, but I needed a coach.
Well, the guys from Zenith, is it Zenith? The Zenith, boys were from the Abseilers. They were fantastic at the top. Right. Well, my wife was Sarita. She was actually crying at the top. So she kind of thought, I don't know if I can do it. So she started crying for a moment. The emotions started to take over. But the guys up the top were fantastic. So they kind of coached her through and said, you're doing great. Look, you're smiling. You're fantastic. You can do this. And but for it is that moment where you think, I cannot do this.
Yes.
And then you just somehow go, well, I have to. And you just find a way.
Sam, you mentioned that reference point. Well, the reference point for me was actually looking at a number. I started to think about a number of our kids and their journeys as children and teenagers and the stuff that they're put up with by their own families or by the system. And, you know, that gives you a bit of motivation saying, God, look what they've gone through. I can move through this.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if they give you male nappies or female nappies, adult nappies, but I reckon that would be an essential part of it. You can face your fears. Raising money for foster kids, you can abseil, as did Brodie Holland and Paul McDonald, Brodie just hours ago. You can abseil down the side of one of the city's tallest buildings on Friday the 27th or Saturday the 28th of April. There's just 200 places. Now, what you have to do it is to go to altitudeshift.org.au.
That's right.
Altitudeshift, all one word, .org.au. And you have to meet a minimum fundraising target, which, sadly, I think you've set way too low.
Well, what we do find, it's $1,000, by the way, or it's $150 to register and then to raise the rest of that up to $1,000. Maybe so, John, but what we do find is that people just keep going past that.
And, I reckon you could easily set the bar at double that. Anyway, there's only 200 places, and if you would like one of them, you have to go to altitudeshift.org.au, and you too can go abseiling down the side of the St. James skyscraper in Bourke Street in the city. Brodie Holland and Paul McDonald. Brodie's now with the Caroline Springs Football Club. Wow. And doing all sorts of other great things. Paul McDonald's the boss of Anglicare. Our next guest with Sam Lane, my co-host on The Conversation Hour, in just a moment. Rory O'Neill is over here from...
Need that coach.
Over here from Ireland. He's an activist, comedian, and the drag queen Panty Bliss, performing a show called Riot. So Sam Lane's here for Roar. Brodie and Paul were here for Panic, and now Rory's here for Riot, Fairfax Studio Arts Centre, Melbourne, as part of the Midsummer Festival. Rory, welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you. It's funny you played Small Town Boy, because one of my strongest memories is I was about 16 or 17 and getting the bus home from Dublin for Christmas down to the west of Ireland, and it's pitch dark, and I'm sitting back and I own my very first Walkman, and I have that song on it, and that song is all about a young gay boy who has to feel he has to leave the small town and go to the big city to find his life and everything. I just remember sitting in the back of the bus in the dark crying listening to that song.
Where was home?
Because it spoke to me.
Where was home on the west coast?
Do you want a hug?
How could I say no?
Man hug.
I'd be thrown out of the gay club if I said no to a hug from you. Home was a small town in the west of Ireland, Mayo, County Mayo.
And such a beautiful part of the world, and you just shouldn't keep it all to yourselves. It's simply not fair.
Well, I always say it to foreigners, don't bother with anything in the middle. Just stick to the coast. The rest isn't really Ireland.
No, that's not fair either. So what's the drag scene like over in your country?
It's very different than here. It's one of those weird things. Like, I know nothing about football, for example, so Brody was telling me some stuff earlier outside. And the drag world, I think people don't know, they don't get all the nuances. Whereas, drag scenes are very different in different countries. So, like, the kind of drag and the kind of show you would see...
Well, we think Priscilla. What are you guys?
Yeah, so ours would be much more wordy. Like, or maybe that's from the Irish tradition. Yeah, kind of. A lot more stand-up sort of vibe about it. And just the look would be totally different too. Like, Australia's famous for its foam wigs and all those kind of the Priscilla look and all that. And of course the weather. I see these Australian queens and they're wearing practically nothing, and I'm like, oh my god.
And so there's more music in Australian drag. Is that?
Like if you go to a club here, you see a lot of what they call production shows, where they have the whole show, you know, set out, and maybe for 2 months, I don't know exactly how long, but they'll be the same show and they have the same numbers and the costume changes and all of that. They would tend to be much looser in Ireland, more like a stand-up really show.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it's
the Irish storytelling tradition is what I think it is. I mean, that's what I do. My shows, I just tell stories, really.
You're reminding me, one of my favourite travelling stories was actually going to London, I think, for the second time. And I knew a friend from school was living there and I hadn't seen him since school, you know, high school. And he said, and because we got sort of linked up because he was there, I just thought, oh, well, I don't know anyone else, so I'll just ring him. And he said, oh, I'm in a show tonight, so come and see me. And I was like, cool. So I turned up and there he was performing drag in London. And I was like, I had no idea. And it was amazing. Like, it was the most spectacular show. And this was this insight into someone who I'd known at school. And I just had no idea what he'd done since. And
it's funny.
It was the best blind date ever.
Some of you, if you were flying on Qantas last year, you might have been forced to watch a movie about me. And everybody always asks me one particular thing is because I'm from a very small village. Like they say the population is 2,000, but I'm always dubious about that. Like, it's a tiny town in the west of Ireland. And by accident, because that had been arranged before we knew it, literally the weekend after the Ireland's gay marriage referendum vote, I went down to a full show for the tiny little village that I come from in a marquee that the village had put up in the car park of the local tire business. And the whole town came and there's like, all, you know, whatever, it's packed out. There's the old ladies on the plastic chairs. Oh. It was kind of like Sunday Mass. The men are all at the back, standing up at the back. And it just really said, my God, the world has changed. Yeah. Like when I was growing up, I could not have imagined that.
Riddle me this. Here's a country that's steeped in Catholic tradition where the word of the priest was absolutely uncontradictable. The church argued and lobbied against these moves, and yet the population said, don't care, and went the other way. So how has that bond been so weakened?
Well, first of all the scandals in the church, from the institutional abuse and so on, all really decimated the power of the church in Ireland. I was actually saying to Rory, and I was outside that, my uncle is a priest in England, but he won't wear his collar when he comes to Ireland anymore, and hasn't in about 15 years, I'd say, because he'll get abuse in the street. So that has all changed so dramatically. But then also, some people do sort of wonder, sometimes say, Ireland voted for gay marriage and blah, blah, blah. You know, I say, but Ireland really is what it is it's very small, tight communities, and family is very important, and your neighbours and all that. And you know, the world has changed so much that every single Irish person, it's impossible to live in Ireland and not know a gay person. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the lesbian who's teaching your kids, or your, you know, Peter and Joe who live next door, or your brother or your uncle or whatever it is. And that totally trumps, you know, in Irish society, those kind of connections trump any sort of ideological stuff that, you know, a priest might tell you.
And so, Rory, when the vote went in Ireland, was it a similar process to Australia in that regard?
Similar. Ours didn't drag on quite so long as yours because we had to change the constitution.
Right.
So there was a referendum. And the referendum was binding and proper referendum. So, I mean, you guys, you kind of dragged it out for so long, whether you were going to have a referendum or a plebiscite or a postal survey or whatever.
And, of course, there's been a complete collapse of public morals, both in this country and yours ever since then.
Yes, the sky fell down and children are running through the streets on fire. Ireland's a horrible, horrible place now.
Well, those who were opposed to it, of course, said that it was leading to some irreversible decline, and they described Sodom and Gomorrah, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not happened. It's not happened
God
where you're
damn
from.
It.
It's not happened here, and it's not happened anywhere where these laws have been changed. Yeah. People just get on with it.
Well, I'll say one thing. I thought that the day after our vote, the only difference would be is that some gay people would decide to get married. And otherwise, I thought everything was exactly the same. But actually, I have to say that isn't exactly what happened, because actually doing it by referendum I felt was ended up being much more powerful than I'd expected. Because if they had just brought it in legislatively, like they have in most countries, for starters, the argument is never over. So, for example, in France, they've had gay marriage for years, but it is still a live, burning issue. They have marches and demonstrations, and a conservative government could come in tomorrow and change it. Whereas in Ireland, it's a finished conversation because the whole country debated it, like here, endlessly for months on end. We all got together, we all voted on, and it's over. And even the people who were vehement no's would say, yeah, it's over now.
Well, it's not over in their mind. I mean, there is a backlash movement in Australia. There are people in Australia who want to reverse those laws. They want to reverse the voluntary euthanasia laws that we've introduced here. They want to reverse the abortion reforms of many years ago now. And they're saying, well, we are dedicated to undoing what they regard as terrible mistakes.
But in Ireland, we'd have to have another referendum to take it out of the Constitution.
That's not
no politician will ever sort of, because even when it's done, it's done. But the other thing, though, is it Ireland and Australia, the queers in Ireland and Australia are in a unique position in the world, is that and we know exactly to a percentage point what the rest of the country thinks about us. And I suspected and believed and would have hoped that most Irish people were fine with me before the referendum. I didn't know that. Mm. Now I do know that. Mm. And it has had a real sort of, it ended up having a real sort of empowering kind of weirdly effect. So, for example, in Ireland now, you see gay couples holding hands in the street all the time in a way that you never did before. Mm. And that literally started the day of the referendum result. They just feel
indeed,
freer,
Sam,
you, confident.
You touch on this and that extraordinary triumphant kiss at the award ceremony for Erin Phillips at the end of the AFLW season, the women's footy season last year.
Yeah, I describe it as a shopfront window like the AFL had never had before.
Mm.
And to put it into context for our international guest, elite men like Brody have played footy. Elite men typically have taken Sarita Stella, now Sarita Holland, I think, to the Brownlow Medal, to the events, all of this. After the first AFL women's season, which was only this time last year, at the big awards night, the woman that won best player of the entire season took her wife, an American former elite basketballer. They have two kids. And naturally, when Erin Phillips was crowned winner, she leant over and kissed her wife on the mouth. The moment was snapped in frozen gold forever, photographic, and it was put all over the papers. And this, I say in this book, Raw, I mean this...
What's the name of the book again?
The book is called Raw. Raw. Roar. Roar.
And it's
that's your accent. That's
it's
your accent.
O, not A. Yeah. Anyway, that was part of the AFLW effect.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, suddenly this code, and Brody would talk about this, we don't have another hour, but... The code was actually crying out for this liberation.
Yeah. Look, I find it interesting that that really there hasn't been an AFL player that's kind of come out at this stage. A man. It would be fantastic for the game. And look, we all know that was probably, I would know one or two that I'd played with, but they were just too cautious about their approach. And not
played
wanting to
with
come
or
out.
Against?
Played. Oh, look, both. Yeah. Both.
He's narrowing it down, is he?
And, but look, it's the percentages say that there's a lot more than I would have known.
Sure.
Obviously the guys are still in that environment for whatever reason, or you can, you know, there's many reasons, obviously, but they haven't been coming out, and I would think it'd be amazing for the game.
In soccer, it's pretty much the same. There's no really yet because, but in Gaelic football, we've a few,
right?
Hurling,
yeah.
Now, listen, don't be asking me any specifics. I think they're all Gaelic footballers. There's two of them are brothers. Mm. I think they're all football rather than hurling.
Well, a gay Gaelic footballer, it's sort of poetic, isn't it?
I must say, Rory, you got a point there about people being more public in the expression of their sexuality since the vote. I catch public transport all the time, and since the vote, I've noticed, you know, for more same-sex couples holding hands on the train, those sort of things. Well, I didn't really notice that, or that wasn't evident before. I mean, there's been a great permission or affirmation in this tough process it was.
Yeah. I think that definitely happened in Ireland anyway. And part of it also is not sort of the opposite. It's in the way that, like, let's say you're like a little, you know, young lesbian couple at a bus stop late at night in Dublin, you know, before the referendum. It wasn't that you would really fear that somebody might beat you up. Ireland doesn't really like that. But somebody might say, oh, you bloody dykes or something. But even that, who cares? Mm. You know, it, you know, you're tough, whatever. But the fear is that maybe everybody else at the bus stop would sort of agree with them.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas since the vote, the attitude is, well, like, even if some idiot says something, well, yeah. you know, those young lesbians know, well, actually, you know, mm. I know for a fact that, the, you know, that 70% of the people at the bus stop think you're the dickhead.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and that's yeah. really, there's something... Can I say dickhead?
Twice.
Mom.
You've got one more strike to go.
Richard Head. I'm talking about Richard. You know Richard.
Just offended all the Richards out
there. Oh, Dickie Attenborough.
Right, thanks. Okay, Rory O'Neill, comedian, drag queen, stars as Panty Bliss, Queen of Ireland, in a riot at the Fairfax Studios, part of the Midsummer Festival.
So I don't, we left this interview a bit late.
Until the 9th of February, as part of the Midsummer Festival. Rory, welcome to Melbourne, and I hope the city is kind to you. Brodie Holland, former AFL player, now head coach at Carolyn Springs Football Club, has been dangling off a piece of string off the side of a building. Paul McDonald's done it too from Anglicare, and they're inviting you, if you can raise at least $1,000, you can grab one of the 200 only spots to raise funds for Anglicare by doing the same thing, by abseiling down the side of the St James building. It's taking place in April 27th and 28th. Plenty of time for you to get your affairs in order before you do it. AltitudeShift.org.au. It's all about raising consciousness, awareness, but also money. AltitudeShift.org.au. If you'd like to do that in April. And Sam Lane is my co-host today from Channel 7, where she's a sports journalist from time to time. And she's written a book called...
I'm not saying it. You've made me really embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. I'm new at this. Never
Too early to be embarrassed, Sam. Just keep going with
I've never
it.
Never done it before.
The
John.
Story is behind kind. AFLW. And you're being reminded, didn't you go for a ride on the back of a speedway bike with Jason Crump?
Yes.
And you say you don't take risks?
It was scarier at the Adelaide Oval at heights.
I can well understand. Sam, Raw is the name of the book. Raw, Rory O'Neill, Brodie Holland, Paul McDonald. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.